It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Working-age men are dropping out of the labor force in rural Wisconsin, and it follows a nationwide trend. According to federal data, over 1 in 10 men aged 25 to 54 are out of the workforce. That's down from nearly 100% labor force participation by men in the 1950s. Now, new research finds that men, among other things, are leaving jobs after feeling disrespected by leadership and losing enthusiasm for the work. Sarah Halpern-Meekin is a professor in the School of Human Ecology in the La Follette School of Public Affairs and director of the Institute for Research on Poverty at UW-Madison. Sarah, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me.
You interviewed dozens of these men from across rural Wisconsin for your research. Where did you go to find them?
Well, we tried to reach people in a lot of different ways. So we put up flyers across all different communities, you know, in laundromats and libraries. And we put up posts on, you know, Craigslist gig sites to try to reach people. One of the things that can be challenging with this sort of research is we're trying to reach a group who's defined by not being someplace, and trying to find people who are not someplace is a little trickier than reaching people who are in a particular place.
I want to go right into some of these interviews you did. One man you spoke with, Grant, said he was let go from a dairy farm after years because he lacked a specialized degree. How is education a predictor of men seeking work?
So, you know, one of the things that you talked about at the beginning is this drop we've seen in prime-age men's labor force participation. Prime-age men are those 25 to 54-year-olds. And we've seen a starker decline in labor force participation for men who have the lowest levels of education, like less than a high school degree. We've seen some decline for men with a high school degree. And those declines have been starker than what we've seen for men with a college degree.
And Grant raked leaves, picked up lots of side hustles. What effect does the gig economy have on these men who are out of the formal workforce?
Often, I think when we talk about the gig economy, we think about somebody driving for Lyft or Uber or DoorDash or something like that. Those are not similarly options in rural areas the way they are for people living in urban areas. And so the kind of gig work that we saw people picking up looked a lot more like stuff that's been around for a long time. Raking leaves, like you talked about, finding side construction jobs, somebody who needs, you know, a new set of tiles installed in their house and picking up that job and working for cash under the table.
You write about men thinking of formal work as assaults on their dignity. How would you describe the sense of dignity that you found in these men?
They felt like they should be treated okay on the job, and that they shouldn't be disrespected and shown a real disregard for what they contributed on the job. And so it's not that they didn't value work, it's that they valued work, their hard work, and they wanted their bosses and their coworkers to similarly respect them on the job. And so that could look like, you know, one man we talked to talked about having severely injured his arm on the job. And when he paged his boss to say, "I got hurt," she didn't respond for hours. And then eventually he was told to just head home. And nobody checked on him. So those kinds of things, right? It's about being shown care, like you matter, that you have value at work, the sort of things that most of us would want to receive on the job.
In terms of injury, a stat from your research, nearly two-thirds of people out of work point to their own illness or disability as the number one reason. What did you learn about the mental and physical health of the men you interviewed?
So mental and physical health are big reasons why men are out of the labor force. So when we look at the reasons why women describe being out of the labor force during those prime age years, the most common reason they give is that they're doing caregiving work. For men, the most common reason they give is that they're dealing with a disability or another kind of health issue.
Your research found men outside the labor force may have a subculture that rejects expertise and mainstream institutions. How are men's feelings towards, you know, institutions affecting workforce participation? Can you kind of parse that?
Yeah, so I think some people expect that there's going to be a subculture of rejecting work or rejecting expertise. And what we saw was something pretty different, that there was a real respect for hard work and that they took pride in the areas that they had expertise in, that those were things they felt proud of, jobs they had done well at, skills that they had, the abilities they had to figure something out, right? To figure out how to fix something when they needed to do things for themselves. And so we saw this real dedication to hard work and doing for yourself. So even though they were out of the labor force, that didn't mean they didn't have a regard for work.
And that's what I really took away strongly from learning the stories of these men, that the meaning of work, not just the wage, the income, really matters, that it is really about what you're contributing.
Yeah, exactly. People want to do work that feels meaningful. And that meaning can come from the relationships that you have with your boss and your coworkers. The meaning can come from looking back on the work that you've done at the end of the day and feeling like you've contributed something. So men told us about, for example, working on building projects and being able to look back and think, I helped build that house. Or Grant, who you brought up, talking about the feeling good about having taken care of these cows and had them had calves and had those calves grow up and being able to feel this sense of what we call generativity, right? That you've contributed something to the world. And that feeling was sometimes hard to come by with many of the job opportunities that were available to them. You know, if you're going to tighten a certain piece on a factory floor 7,000 times every shift, that needs some more support to feel like you're really contributing to something larger than yourself.
We're talking about a rise in men opting out of the workforce with Sarah Halpern-Meekin, professor in the School of Human Ecology and the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. Sarah, what could employers take away from your research, and how could they convince men to rejoin the labor force? What needs to change?
So the conversation has really been about pay and benefits, and I certainly don't disregard those things. Those things matter, right? Pay and benefits matter. They matter because they're compensation, but the other way that they matter is they're a show of respect for somebody. So to pay a longtime worker less than you pay a new worker, that matters because of the dollars and cents, but it also matters because it can be felt as a sign of disrespect for the seniority and skills that somebody is bringing to the job. So thinking about how employees are treated, what respect are they shown, what sense are they given that they are part of a larger mission, and not just talking the talk, but walking the walk. So having the pay and benefits, the opportunities for promotion, the responsibility and power on the job, the autonomy that people have over their work to back up those statements. So not just saying, yes, we value everyone here, but thinking about how you show that way of valuing all of your employees.
In terms of the job opportunities available to these men, I mean, we're seeing that, you know, over half of Wisconsin's counties have fewer jobs than in 2019. Could a decline in opportunities affect these men?
Yes, absolutely. A decline in opportunities is part of what's going on, right? And so it means that there are fewer jobs that are attractive, that are appealing. It means that people face a trade-off. Do you stay in your community where you have long-term relationships with your friends, neighbors, and family, or do you move for work? And I think those are really important decisions that we don't just want to think about at an individual level, but we want to think about what happens to our communities when the people who are most able and willing to move for better job opportunities do so. What does that do for our rural communities?
In terms of the world around us, former President Trump will be sworn in later this month. Some political analysts say that Trump really tailored his campaign to appeal to disaffected men. How might a Trump presidency affect how men view the workforce?
So I think that remains to be seen what happens, what kind of policies come to pass. One of the things that we'll be paying attention to, for example, are what happens with our trade. You know, it affects people if prices rise because we have new tariffs or things like that, because that affects the cost of living for people. We're just going to really need to pay attention to what kind of investments there are from the federal government that come down to states and local communities that can create opportunities, invest in workforce development, both at the individual level and in terms of supporting employers at having job opportunities that work well for the local workforce.
As we wrap up here, traditionally men have been called the breadwinner in traditional family roles. And I'm wondering if you got a sense from these interviews that the men had found peace in their lives and their role in their community, and did they feel settled?
I think many of the men felt that they had an obligation to contribute to their families that's different than having an obligation to be the sole breadwinner. So Grant, who you mentioned at the beginning, right, he talked about how he and his wife both contributed to their family, and she had a formal job at a retail establishment. And so she had those formal earnings, and he supplemented that by doing all of the other kinds of jobs that he did. So his wages were more fluctuating than hers, but he felt it was important that they both contributed. Many of the men also did caregiving for children, for sick family members. So while they were out of the formal labor force, they were still also finding other ways to contribute to their family through those gig jobs, cash jobs, caregiving, and then also self-provisioning, hunting, gardening, things like that, building and fixing things around the house.
Sarah, thank you so much for sharing your research with us. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah Halpern-Meekin is a professor in the School of Human Ecology in the La Follette School of Public Affairs, director of the Institute for Research on Poverty at UW-Madison. We've been talking about her research on why men lead the labor force in their prime working years. She was lead author of a recent article in the journal Rural Sociology called The Dignity of Non-Working Men. Coming up on Wisconsin Today, as the top Democrat in the U.S. Senate endorses the chair of Wisconsin's Democratic Party to lead the national party, we talk with Ben Wickler about his ambitions for the DNC.
I have a different view about how we pursue the goal to expand the pie for every state.
That conversation is just ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Many Wisconsin counties have been providing long-term care to residents for a century or longer. And today, the state has the second most county-owned nursing homes in the country. But that might be changing. Despite the county facility's reputation for high-quality care, a slew of county boards proposed sales to for-profit buyers this year. They say their counties can't afford to keep the facilities running. But as Addie Costello reports, those sales could come at the cost of residents' care.
It's not hard for 86-year-old Arlene Meyer to stay busy.
People say, in here? Yeah.
Meyer sits in her room at Pinecrest, a county-owned nursing home in Merrill, where she reads off her monthly event calendar.
Now, this is only on Sunday. Trivia they have, which is enjoyable, makes the brain work.
Followed by a storytelling workshop, a sing-along, and...
Then on television, they're having Packers and Lions on Fox with popcorn.
On other days, there's chair Zumba, bingo, animal therapy, and even beer pong. The activities are her favorite thing about Pinecrest.
I love it here. I sincerely do.
But she worries that will change. The Lincoln County Board started looking for a for-profit buyer last year.
I was teed off about it. Now I think about it and think, you know, what jerks were running this?
Wisconsin has more county-owned nursing homes than most states. Experts say that's likely because Wisconsin residents and leaders prioritize keeping people closer to their homes. the state had 57 county-owned nursing homes in the late 70s. Today, there are 36. In Wisconsin and across the country, for-profit ownership has risen. Counties aren't required to run a nursing home. So during tough financial times, experts say facilities like Pinecrest often face sales. Lincoln County Board Chair Jesse Boyd says the county is working to get its expenses under control, but
right now we're drowning.
It's not just Lincoln County. This year, St. Croix County discussed a sale, Washington County's nursing home officially sold, Sauk County voted to sell, and Portage County leaders say they hope to find a buyer within a year. As Wisconsin's population ages, the state can't afford to lose nursing home beds, something Boyd recognizes.
We're just doing what we need to do to maintain a nursing home in Lincoln County.
These sales are happening right as increased Medicaid reimbursements could improve their financial picture. Renee Eastman is a vice president at Leading Age Wisconsin.
If counties hung on for a little bit longer, they would really see the effects of that funding infusion and really how important these services are.
Federal Medicare data shows Wisconsin's county-owned facilities, on average, have higher quality of care and draw fewer complaints than facilities in the state owned by for-profits. And facilities like Pinecrest that offer workers county benefits tend to be better staffed, with less turnover.
We own it. It's our place. We all take pride in it being here, and we feel like it's important to a community.
That's Dora Gorski. Her late husband, Ken, moved into Pinecrest when he had advanced dementia. It meant a lot to her that many staff and residents already knew him from Aikido classes he taught or his time working in healthcare.
This is full of neighbors and friends and people from our community, people who love us and know us.
Something she says you don't find in a big city.
And you don't find that in a private for-profit nursing home. You find it in a county-owned, community-run nursing home.
With the majority of Lincoln County board members currently in favor of selling and interested buyers lined up, Pinecrest isn't likely to stay county-owned for long, something Gorski and organizers across the state plan to keep fighting. Addie Costello, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This piece was produced in partnership with the nonprofit Wisconsin Watch. This is Wisconsin Today. After losing both the race for president and control of the U.S. Senate in the November election, the Democratic National Committee will be electing a new chairperson on February 1st. One of the candidates hoping to lead the national party is Ben Wickler, chair of the Wisconsin Democrats since 2018. Yesterday, now Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer endorsed Wickler for the role, saying he was, quote, a tenacious organizer and a proven fundraiser. Before Schumer's endorsement, we caught up with Ben Wickler to discuss how his experience organizing campaigns in Wisconsin could carry over to the national stage. He talked with Rob Ferret just before the holidays. Here's a listen.
All right, big turning point here in some ways for the Democratic Party, looking for this new national leadership. Why you? Why now?
Well, this is a moment when the whole country faces a version of what we saw in Wisconsin. We have Trump and his kind of Mar-a-Lago billionaire cabinet coming into power. They're pretty clear that they want to rig this whole country for the benefit of a tiny number of the richest people in the world at the very top, at the expense of everyone else. And it reminds me of what we saw with Scott Walker coming in and smashing unions and going after voting rights and gerrymandering our state to try to rig Wisconsin for the benefit of the very few at the expense of the many. And I think we need to fight back. We need to have a national party that can organize in the fight for working people in every state across this country with the same kind of intensity and focus that we've been able to bring to the work in Wisconsin, especially over these last few years, building on you know, years of work before that. So I'm running for DNC chair to unite our party to fight up and down the ballot with a strategy for every state that changes how we organize and communicate so we're present year-round in all the places people get their news and information and in their own communities and their lives, and win a ton more elections at every level of the ballot so we can contain the damage but also build a path to actually being able to win elections and deliver for working folks, no matter where they live or what they look like across the country.
What do you see in particular you could take from Wisconsin and bring to the national stage and help apply in other states as well?
In Wisconsin, we build an integrated campaign that operates year-round and works at every level. And what I mean by that is we work on mayor's races and city council races and school board races. We fought in state Supreme Court races, and that led to a state Supreme Court that actually read our constitution and struck down the gerrymander. And this year we flipped 14 state legislative seats at the same time as, you know, there was a national red wave. We added votes for Democrats statewide, and Trump did win because he added even more, but Tammy Baldwin won because a lot of those Trump voters only voted for Trump. When we turn folks out, we're asking them to vote for Democrats at every level of the ballot. And if you compare that to, let's say, North Carolina, a few years ago, Republicans invested, they flipped their state Supreme Court majority. The Supreme Court there re-rigged North Carolina. Democrats lost 3 U.S. House seats, and now Republicans have a House majority nationwide because Republicans focused on those down ballot races. And I want to support state parties all across the country fighting up and down the ballot in ways that can have enormous consequences for the whole country. This is not just about showing up every 4 years. It's about a permanent campaign. And I think we've shown that in Wisconsin. Right now, we have our state Supreme Court race this spring, Susan Crawford versus Brad Schimmel. That is a must-win race. And we're going to fight to win that. And we should be doing the same thing in every state around the country.
On a technical level, the Association of State Democratic Chairs has proposed that the National Party redistribute 50% of fundraising to state operations. You support that, I understand. What would that mean?
I have a different view about how we pursue the goal to expand the pie for every state. It's not coming in with a fixed percentage off the top. It's building a plan based on the fights that are going to happen and finding the resources to win those fights. That will mean more resources going to states, but it's not coming in with a one-size-fits-all cookie cutter. You know, Wisconsin is the only state with a giant fight on April 1st that is existential, the Supreme Court majority, and we're going to need a ton of resources to make sure Susan Crawford beats Brad Schimmel and we don't get re-rigged the way North Carolina did. So this spring, it's not 50-50. Wisconsin has to be a front and center in this battle. And then this fall, we've got New Jersey and Virginia, and they have critical elections in those states. And meanwhile, in tons of states, there are local elections and special elections. Let's build a battle plan that is fit to purpose around these fights and take every level of the ballot seriously. And that way, Wisconsin will have a Supreme Court majority that believes in freedom and democracy and will be winning local fights across the country. That's my approach to this is it starts with the fight and the plan to win. That's how I think we raise more resources, and that's how we get more resources into the states.
After the 2024 elections, I've seen kind of two stories from some Democrats. One is panic, lost the White House. Republicans now control both chambers or will control both chambers of Congress in January. It's a huge loss. Radical change is needed. On the other hand, people saying narrow popular vote majority for Donald Trump, narrow majority for Republicans in Congress, Senate. It was a tough map. The pendulum is just going to swing back, maybe even naturally. Where do you fit in?
I have a hybrid view, which is that we did almost win and the pendulum is likely to swing our way and we should be shooting more, but for more than to win by a hair's breadth based on political momentum. The views of Democrats that we should have a country that works for working people, that every person deserves freedom and dignity and opportunity and respect. Those views are wildly popular. And the goal should be to win by a lot more than 1%. We should be winning in a lot of places that look red on the map right now. If we can communicate and fight and organize everywhere, and if we do work like with the work we're going to do in our Supreme Court race this spring, we have a path, I think, to having a significant majority, to having a federal trifecta and Democratic leadership in a ton more states in a way that we can build over these next 4 years. So I do think we shouldn't overestimate the strength of the Republicans, but we also shouldn't underestimate how strong Democrats can be if we can actually get our message out and show up for people and demonstrate that who we're fighting for, which is the vast majority of this country, and who the other side is for, which is a tiny group trying to rig the whole system for the benefit of a tiny handful of people at the top.
You mentioned working people, and that seems to be one of the biggest challenges for Democrats right now. Republicans making gains with working people or non-college educated voters. There are different proxies for that. Not just white working class voters, but some move toward Republicans among Black and Hispanic working class voters. How do you turn that around? Is it a messaging issue? What do you think Democrats need to do?
First, I want to agree. When I say working folks, it's white, black, Latino, you know, Asian American, Pacific Islanders, Native American. Most Americans, they work for a living. They don't have a bunch of assets, stock market portfolios that are growing in value that they can live off of. This is a predominantly working class country. And I think we got to fight for folks in a way that they can see and touch and feel. And, you know, next year we know Trump is going to try to pass a tax cut for the wealthiest people in the world at the expense of the middle class. It's something he did when he was president last time. We need to fight in a way that shows folks that we're on their side, that we're the ones who are going to try to make sure that they can afford the medicine they need and be able to see a doctor without sacrificing the food that their family needs to eat or their chance to have a roof over their head. We're the party that for generations has fought for working folks to be able to form a union and organize and collectively bargain in their workplaces, and for things like Social Security that have provided a floor for folks so you don't have to live out your final days in poverty. This is stuff that affects folks in every community across the country. And Republicans try to always divide and distract and try to pull people's attention away from these central economic questions about who our country and our economy should work for. So when you look at how we lost in 2024, we lost by 16 percentage points among people who never pay attention to political news. We won by 8 points among people who pay attention all the time. It's not that people who heard our message rejected it. It's that we didn't reach a ton of people with our message. And we have to clarify that message. We have to make sure we're using language that people actually use in real life, not just what feels like a political ad. But then we have to get out and speak to folks who are not tuning in to the political news cycle, find it all stressful, think, you know, both parties are full of it. We have to be present in the places and the conversations where they're making sense of the world and showing that we're on their side and making clear when the other side is trying to pull the wool over their eyes and rip them off. And if we can do that, I think we have a chance to win big up and down the ballot.
How do you do that?
It goes across the country. Well, to start with, you know, look at where young people get their news. And this is, again, across race and ethnicity. They do not listen to traditional radio very much. They don't read newspapers like ever. They don't watch cable news. They're on YouTube and streaming platforms and TikTok and vertical video and long form podcasts and Discord channels and giant chat rooms. And Republicans are actually investing in making sure that folks carry their message in those places. We need to do that as Democrats. We need to show up where people's, you know, their eyeballs and their attention and their where their ear, you know, AirPods are actually taking them. And that means building a kind of war room that is built for the 21st century and not just for the 20th century, at lifting up a whole new generation of communicators, making sure that every day we're driving it home in ways that connect to the broad argument that we're on the side of working folks in this country, and then choosing the fights that people will really remember. The way that we fought against the repeal of the Affordable Care Act in 2018, young people under 26 who were going to lose their health insurance, their ability to stay on their parents' health insurance if Republicans succeeded, they got energized. They got energized in youth participation in elections. And most young people are working class folks. It shot up. And I think we're going to have fights like that going forward. So it's how and where we communicate, who's doing the communicating, messengers that can speak directly to the impact that these things have on their lives and be clear about who's on their side and who's not. And then the fights that we fight, the fights we pick that show our values and show the other side's values. That is how you break through, is because people remember who's on their side when the chips are down. And we know that Trump is going to try to do a million terrible things. We have the chance now to choose the biggest fights to put front and center in the American consciousness that demonstrate our values as Democrats.
One of the biggest shifts in American politics, the decline of conservative Democrats and even some moderate Democrats in places around the country. You had somebody like Joe Manchin, a Democrat who could win in West Virginia, reviled by many people in the liberal part of the party. Do you see room for more moderate or even conservative-ish Democrats to win states like West Virginia or, you know, Western states?
We're a Big Ten party, and, you know, different Democrats disagree about all kinds of things. And, you know, if you look at, like, the campaigns that Democrats were running in a state like Montana, it was quite different from the campaigns that Democrats were running in a state like New York. There are certain core values that make us Democrats, and, you know, we're going to always fight for those values. And also, we recognize that a lot of people will disagree on a lot of things. I also think we're in a moment where the right has become so extreme that just believing that, you know, the people should have the right to make their own decisions about their own body puts you outside of the Democratic, excuse me, puts you outside of the Republican Party's tent. They are running purity tests and litmus tests and kiss the Donald Trump's ring tests all the time. And I think that we're the party that says, look, if you want to make a country that works for everyone, where everyone has these basic freedoms and respect, then join the big Democratic coalition and fight with us to make this work. And that message, I think, is going to have a lot of resonance in a lot of places where people may have voted for Trump just because they were fed up and frustrated. The price of eggs was high and they weren't paying a lot of attention to the actual policies that Trump wants to inflict on this country. Those policies are deeply, deeply unpopular. And I think we have a chance to make a real case that we represent something better and that through our actions, we're going to demonstrate our values, that we're going to fight for folks.
As we wrap up, we've been mostly looking toward the future. A brief look back. Did Democrats make a mistake in just rubber stamping Joe Biden's reelection campaign? And then when he stepped down, going right to Kamala Harris without any kind of mini primary or anything like that?
Well, the DNC chair can sometimes affect the future, and that is certainly my goal, but they can't really affect the past. And so my goal in the DNC chair's race is to bring together folks who might have disagreed on a lot of things over the last year and even the last several years and unite us around a vision about how we unite and fight and win up and down the ballot. We are where we are in this moment. And my message to folks who often were in heated disagreement, you know, a few months ago about questions like this is, let's come together around what we can do together now, because the fight is upon us. No matter where folks were, yesterday, tomorrow, we're going to have to decide who we are as a party and whether we're ready for the fight. And that starts, you know, running for DNC chair, the election's February 1st, then April 1st, Susan Crawford versus Brad Schimmel, and then on to the races across the country that are coming throughout this year. This is a moment when we're all going to be called on to live out our values and elect folks who share those values to make sure that this whole country doesn't get rigged and the American experiment doesn't fall under a profound shadow for years to come.
Ben, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
That is Ben Wickler, who chairs the Democratic Party of Wisconsin and is one of the candidates for chair of the Democratic National Committee. The group chooses its new leader on February 1st, and he talked with Rob Ferret. Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, a Menasha restaurant owner wins a national award for her Chicago-style hoagies.
When I create my hoagies, I tap into the inner child in me, and I think we forget to do that. I think if everybody tapped into their inner child, we will be better as people.
The art of sandwich making and keeping a restaurant buzzing. That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's Lee Rayburn with a story about maneuvering through life following winter injuries.
Winter slips and falls are dangerous and can be debilitating. While Milwaukee's Shauna Singh Baldwin was recovering from her slip and fall, she discovered a Wisconsin community of support, ingenuity, and understanding.
From my high-rise window on a bright sunny day last January, I saw Wisconsinites pitching tents and ice fishing on Lake Michigan, and motorcyclists zooming in circles on the ice. I gave in to my urge to walk by the glacial blue eye on a plowed and salted walkway. It didn't look icy until my nose was 5 inches away from the thin veneer of ice. The fall fractured my left radius, and I'm left-handed. I got a brace and sling. A week later, friends drove me to the very competent doctor who applied a hot pink cast. 6 weeks, the doctor assured me, would go fast. Maybe for him. "This is Wisconsin," said my friends. "Don't we all know people who have slipped and broken knees, hips, or ankles? It could have been worse." They patiently ferried me to doctor's appointments, the grocery store, the gym. Eastside Senior Services volunteers also provided rides. A friend cooked Indian comfort food and stocked my freezer. I requested help when folding clothes or changing sheets. I couldn't hand wash, so I used paper plates and dishwasher-safe dishes. Some activities, like doing my makeup, were difficult single-handed, but doable. Others were just not. I left some buttons unsewn and hoped to resume playing my guitar and piano soon. I marveled at the ingenuity of strangers who, with amazing forethought, had created assistive devices to make my life easier. Electric jar openers, front-opening bras. The Americans with Disabilities Act had prompted improvements I now depended on. Automatic doors, staircase railings. The doc said I could drive, if I wasn't taking painkillers. Soon I had a strap with a handle, enabling me to pull the car door closed. My father-in-law's Irish shillelagh would help me snag the seat belt. They worked. I could drive. I shared my experience with Baljinder Singh, a sophomore studying biomedical engineering at UW-Madison. He said designing assistive devices requires him to know physics, modern materials, computer science, the science of movement, and have empathy. For $150, his team recently modified a walker to obtain data from pressure sensors below its feet to show physiotherapists if their patients are improving. Humans, he feels, will always be better than AI at creating assistive devices for our bodies. I'm relying on Baljinder and his fellow students to invent devices for me and fellow singletons as we age. Meanwhile, maybe I can now write convincingly about a character who slips on ice, breaks her arm, wears a pink cast for 6 weeks, but still drives thanks to assistive devices invented by biomedical engineers.
Shauna Singh Baldwin is an Indo-Canadian-American novelist, playwright, and poet who lives in Milwaukee. She's also a member of the Wisconsin Public Radio Association Board. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Lee Rayburn.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today. The ketchup giant Heinz recently announced the winners of a grant program to celebrate and preserve the legacy of Black culinary traditions in America. Lona Young is one of three winners in Wisconsin. Born and raised in Chicago, Young moved to Menasha 25 years ago and started her restaurant business in 2019. It is fittingly named Chicago's House of Hoagies. And Lona Young joins us now. Welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You are one of three Wisconsin recipients of grants from the Heinz Black Kitchen Initiative this year. What does it mean for you to receive this recognition?
It means a lot. The African-American community, small entrepreneurs don't get that recognition. And to give that to us, that's amazing that they're using their huge platform to say, hey, we need to recognize these people. They work hard. They need help. They need support.
Have you thought about how you'll put this grant to use?
Oh, I've already used it. I used it for my taxes. I used it on taxes and some repairs that I needed to get done at the restaurant. Like those little things you don't really think about when you're sitting down doing your business plan and mapping everything out. You forget that, oh, wait, the garbage disposal might go out. I need to put a fund aside for that. Or maybe the refrigerator goes out and you bought it and it only has a 1-year warranty. So like all those little expenses, they add up so quick. And these are things that you have to keep done in order to keep your business open.
Take us back to 2019. How did House of Hoagies come into being?
From a Facebook post, believe it or not, I made a hoagie and I posted on Facebook like I do all my food because I'm a foodie. I like to eat and show what I'm creating. And I post a hoagie that I had made and I start getting messages from people that I'm friends with. And they thought that I was in Chicago at the House of Hoagies and they were asking me to bring them one back. And I was like, oh no, I made this in my kitchen. And they're like, well, can you make me one? And I was like, no, like, why would you want me to make you a hoagie? But the demand was there. And so I put a post on Facebook like, hey, I'm inviting 30 people to my home for a tasting. I want people who are either from Chicago or Philadelphia, and you have to be an everything eater. You can't come to my house if you don't eat tomatoes or onions or mayo. I don't want you. And I'm not trying to be mean. I need everything eaters, and I need people from them demographics because hoagies are big in those areas. So they're going to be able to critique me, tell me what I need to fix, what they don't like, what they did like. And from there, I got my first catering order. And it was like, the feedback was amazing. I did make some changes based off that first meeting that I had. And it's been doing great. I started doing farmers market and pop-up events and catering. And I was like, maybe this is a thing. I've been doing great. It has had its obstacles, but for the most part, it's been really great.
When you walked into your storefront for the first time, could you believe it?
No. Oh, my God. Once it was all done, mind you, when I started the construction, literally COVID happened.
Yeah.
My construction. And it's like a ton of bricks fall on you. Mm. And you're like, oh, my God, because we're all going through something new that no one's ever experienced. And we don't know the outcome of it. And you've invested all your money into this. You got deposits every place. And the world is shut down.
But you found a way. You found a way.
I did. That was God. That was God. And that was the community. And when I walked in the finishing product, I was like, oh, my God, this young lady from the south side of Chicago, Algale Housing Projects, is doing great things.
Luna, how do these hoagies tell your history, tell your story?
Because I'm from Chicago, and when people see the name Chicago, the first thing they ask when they walk in, are you from Chicago? And then they always want to put you to the test. Well, I wanted to be ahead of the game. So when I created my menu, I wanted to make sure that my menu stamped like, yes, this girl is from Chicago. Not, oh, I'm from Dalton or I'm from Maywood, baby. No, that's not Chicago. Chicago is Chicago with a Chicago zip code. So I made sure that each one of my hoagies told you where I am from, what neighborhoods I hung out, and where me and my friends hung out. For example, I have a Ford City hoagie. That's going to tell my Chicago people like, oh, my God, her and her friends hung out at the Ford City Mall. She's legit, you know, or I'm from Algale Housing Projects. I have a hoagie called Algale Gardens. They're going to, oh, she's from out south. She's from 131st in Michigan. She's the real deal. She knows how we like our food. It's going to be messy. It's going to be flavorful. And that's how you keep that customer base, because people want to know that you're authentic. They walk into a New York deli, they want to feel like they're walking into like that bodega in their neighborhood. If people walk into a Chicago restaurant, they want to feel like they're walking into their neighborhood. They don't want to come and it's like, she ain't even make this right. This doesn't feel like home. You want the food to feel like home. So my menu tells you I'm from Algale Housing Projects. I live in Block 13 on 131st in Michigan. And I have all those hoagies on my menu.
These hoagies tell such a rich story. We're talking with Lona Young, who owns a sandwich shop, House of Hoagies. It's in Menasha and recipient of a recent grant aimed at strengthening the presence of Black culinary traditions in American food culture. You found success with your business on social media, particularly you're crushing TikTok. What has social media meant for your business?
I get most of my customers off of social media because we live in a social media world right now. So people are on social media. So my platforms is Facebook, TikTok, Instagram. And as a small business owner, you have to remember, you have to be consistent with those platforms. You have multi-billion dollar companies like Walmart, Target, Sheen who are aggressively on these platforms. So that should tell you, as a small business owner, you have to be aggressive as well. And I get a lot of traffic off of those.
Through the thick and thin of creating these hoagies, do you have a favorite one? Do you have a standby?
Oh my God, my favorite, hands down. Well, I have a few, but my top two is going to be the Ford City and the River Oak. So the Ford City is, it comes on an ungrilled hoagie roll with mayo, provolone cheese, pepper jack cheese, sliced chicken deli meat, tomatoes and onions with cheese potato chips on top, salt and pepper and olive oil. Oh my God. That just screams childhood memories. I got to get home before the street lights. I can hold this and run with my friends and play, you know? And it's crazy because when I create my hoagies, I tap into the inner child in me. And I think we forget to do that. When I create, I want to make sure I'm tapping into your inner childhood because that's going to make you a better person. And then my next one is the River Oaks. That one comes on an ungrilled hoagie roll with provolone and pepper jack cheese, sliced chicken deli meat, tomatoes and onions, pickle slices, mild banana peppers, salt, pepper, mayo, basil, and avocado oil. That is my I can eat that one probably every day. That one is so amazing. And if you're a true Chicagoan, baby, we love extra oil and basil and we want it dripping down our arm.
Oh my goodness, my mouth is watering. Do you have a New Year's resolution for yourself or for Chicago's House of Hoagies, something you're really looking forward to trying to achieve next?
A lot of people don't know that I have a Feed the Children thing that I do in my restaurant. So if any child walks in my restaurant and tell me that they're hungry, there's no questions asked. I feed them. I don't need to know your story. I don't need to know any of that. I'm going to feed you. So I just, one of my things I do offer in the community. And then once a year, this year was my first event. I did a Feed the Community event where I fed the community. No questions asked. It was a free to the community. I did free face painting for the kids, free bounce house. We gave away free diapers, ties for men that were trying to get back into the workforce. And we fed everybody, no matter race, color, creed, age, whatever. If you're hungry and you need to eat, come and eat. We waste so much food in this country. No one should ever go hungry. So I'm all about, I'm going to feed you.
Lona, this has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us and congratulations.
Oh, you're welcome. And thank you so much for having me on the show. I appreciate this a lot.
Lona Young is the owner of Chicago's House of Hoagies in Menasha, and she is one of three Wisconsin winners of the Heinz Black Kitchen Initiative to celebrate and preserve the legacy of Black culinary traditions. And we'd love for you to join the conversation, for you to chime in about your genius sandwich creations. What do you load on? How do you approach your condiments on this perfect sandwich? Or do you have a neighborhood establishment with amazing sandwiches or hoagies? Get in touch with us at WisconsinToday@WPR.org. That's WisconsinToday@WPR.org. We've been learning about the latest research on men who leave the workforce, and at the start of a new year, we want to know about your career plans here in 2025. Are you hoping to get a new job, make the leap into a completely new field, or maybe re-enter the workforce after a time of being away? What are your steps to make this change? On the other hand, have you decided to leave your job or retire? What is behind your decision? Tell us about your job situation and what you're encountering in your industry and your career goals for this year. Email WisconsinToday@WPR.org. That's WisconsinToday@WPR.org. Or you can reach us at this number, 888-642-0232, with a call or a text. And thank you so so much for sharing your story about the world of work. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.